Hey, I want to thank the organizers for inviting me to this wonderful meeting and for giving me the longer time slot. The title that was just read is my workshop title, but since I have a little extra time, I'm giving you my colloquium title on this subject, which is perhaps a little more entertaining. But I know this is the last talk, you're all tired, and I'm not going to present any calculations or technical details, so I think the colloquium version is probably appropriate for a tired audience like this, and probably won't use the whole 50 minutes. But what I want, so there are three key players, Hopf, Handel, Hamilton, and Whitney, three famous mathematicians, play a role in what I want to talk about. Jeff, I feel maybe I have to justify my giving this talk in this session because, patterns in physics, I'm a mathematician, this is a mathematics talk, and I won't have any beautiful, colorful patterns to show you, but, certainly Hamiltonian systems are of interest to physicists, so I have a physics connection there. Like Jeff, I think temporal patterns are legitimate patterns, interesting temporal behavior. And as many people in the audience know, probably all of you, the interesting spatial patterns often can be studied in terms of normal modes or traveling waves. There are various center manifold other reduction methods that can reduce you to ordinary differential equations. So I'm talking only about ordinary differential equations, no spatial patterns at all. But you can imagine your favorite application that this might be relevant to. This is joint work with among other people, Gerard Jost, who uses some of these ideas in water waves. So there are spatial patterns lurking underneath this cover. So the basic problem that I want to investigate here is the following. We all know the Hopf bifurcation theorem, the classical Hopf bifurcation theorem that describes generic mechanism for the birth of a periodic solution from an equilibrium point. There's an important class of differential equations, the Hamiltonian systems, to which the Hopf theorem doesn't apply, but there is an analogous theorem for Hamiltonian systems, the so-called Hamiltonian-Hopf bifurcation. These two theorems give qualitatively quite different results, and they're mutually exclusive, in a way. If you're interested in a dynamical system that's close to but not Hamiltonian, which theory do you use? Do you say, well, it's almost Hamiltonian, so I'll treat it as if it is Hamiltonian, apply the Hamiltonian theory? Or do I say, no, it's not Hamiltonian, I can't do that, but the Hopf theorem is sort of at the limits of its validity, so it doesn't really apply either. So the idea is try to study this interface between classical Hopf bifurcation and Hamiltonian Hopf bifurcation and see how they fit together. So here's an outline of the talk. I will briefly review what probably we all know, the classical Hopf theorem and what a Hamiltonian dynamical system is, mainly just to establish notation and terminology so that I can then go on from there. I will outline the Hamiltonian Hopf bifurcation theorem that I just mentioned, and then perhaps less well-known, we'll talk about some earlier work that I did with Martin Krupa and Stephen Van Hills on one-to-one resonant Hopf bifurcation, but in the dissipative case, non-Hamiltonian case, which leads one to Whitney's umbrella, the third player in this story, and then finally try to answer or partially answer the question that I raised on the previous transparency. So for review then, here is Hopf's classical bifurcation theorem for ordinary differential equations, a system of ODEs with a parameter mu, and he gave sufficient conditions for the bifurcation of a branch of periodic solutions from an equilibrium point as you vary this parameter mu through a critical value. We will assume the equilibrium has been translated to the origin for convenience. You linearize, take the Jacobian matrix or derivative at the origin, and look at the eigenvalues of that matrix. And The theorem then involves three conditions, three Hopf conditions, 1, 2, and 3, which are stated as follows. First of all, this matrix, the linearization, has simple, pure imaginary eigenvalues, and no others on the imaginary axis, at least no others that are integer multiples of this pair, okay, where k is an integer. So these simple imaginary eigenvalues, and in particular no zero eigenvalue, implies that there's a continuous extension of that pair of eigenvalues as we vary mu, because f is assumed to be a smooth function up here. So for mu non-zero, these imaginary eigenvalues can be expected to move off the imaginary axis and have a non-zero real part, which I will call sigma. The next assumption is that the derivative of that real part with respect to the parameter is non-zero, the so-called crossing condition. So as you vary mu, the eigenvalues cross with non-zero speed. Under those conditions, that's enough to show that you have periodic solutions nearby, and there's a normal form of this form here, where R is the amplitude of the periodic solutions. If in this normal form, this coefficient here, the cubic coefficient, taking account of the R out here as well as the R squared, if this cubic coefficient is non-zero when mu equals zero, then you can solve just the leading order terms and get a parabolic shaped branch of periodic solutions. So the equation for this branch is as in the form given here, and it'll be to the left or right depending on the sign of this computable coefficient. The numerator is the cubic coefficient, the denominator is the derivative of the real part, and this is why we needed it non-zero, so we could solve here and have a non-zero denominator. So this gives the classical bifurcation diagram, and whether it's to the right or left then depends on the sign of this coefficient, and we get these classical pictures, the famous figures of Hopf bifurcation, where I'm taking the state space to be just two-dimensional, the mu axis here, if this coefficient C2 times the derivative sigma prime, I don't know how it became an alpha there, if it has, if this coefficient is negative, then the bifurcation is to the right and you have this stable attracting limit cycle. If it's positive, the branch goes to the left and you have an unstable repelling limit cycle. There is a degenerate case between the two. If all of the coefficients in the normal form are zero, for example, if the system is just linear, you then, of course, have a center at mu equals zero that goes stable or unstable to either side. You can think of this center as being this whole family of periodic solutions here projected down onto this plane. They all exist simultaneously, or conversely, you can think of the nonlinearity and dissipation as taking the center and smearing it out along the mu axis so that you now have a unique limit cycle for each value of the parameter mu. I mention that now because it becomes important later, useful later. So in a sense, this is the Hamiltonian case, and these are the dissipative cases. The Lyapunov center theorem is here's Hopf. Okay, I told you this is my colloquium lecture. So just in case you never met Hopf, here he is, and the reference to his paper. All right, now let's switch to Hamiltonian systems again. Just a brief review, probably old hat for all of you, but a dynamical system in n-dimensional space. Let's assume, first of all, that M is even, an even-dimensional space. So I write my coordinates in two parts, Qs and Ps, each of dimension n, half m. A matrix J of this symplectic form with identity here and minus identity down there. If the vector field F has this special form, J times the gradient of H, the Hamiltonian function mapping R to n into R, then we say this is a Hamiltonian system. Or in other words, perhaps more elementary way to write it, is that this 2n-dimensional system can be written as 2n-dimensional systems, one for Q and one for P, where each is the appropriate gradient of the Hamiltonian with respect to the other variables, the So that's the Hamiltonian formulation that goes way back. 1833, I think, is the first reference, first time Hamilton described this type of this approach of using what we now call Hamiltonian function. He used characteristic function, which of course is an overworked word, so we were forced to rename it Hamiltonian. All right, now the Hopf theorem requires that you linearize and look at the eigenvalues of a linearization. So if we try to apply that to a Hamiltonian system, we would linearize, and the question is, what does a linear Hamiltonian system look like? Well, it's especially simple. It's one for which the matrix A is the form JS, where J is the same matrix, same J we had before, and S is a symmetric matrix. And then I'll call such a system a linear Hamiltonian system. The Hamiltonian function then is just this quadratic form with a symmetric matrix S. And if we calculate eigenvalues, what are the eigenvalues then of a Hamiltonian matrix of this form we just defined? They're roots of this characteristic polynomial, and it's not hard to see that in that case the characteristic polynomial is even. It's an even function. So whenever lambda is an eigenvalue, so is minus lambda. And of course, being real, it's also true that whenever you have an imaginary eigenvalue, its conjugate is an eigenvalue, right? The eigenvalues always occur in complex conjugate pairs, but we're saying now for Hamiltonian systems, they apply in quartets. So if I have lambda 2, I also have lambda 2 bar on the imaginary axis. But also, if I have a real eigenvalue, I must have its negative by this property. And if I have a complex eigenvalue on neither axis, I must have both its negatives and its conjugates. So eigenvalues, complex eigenvalues appear in quartets. And that means if I try to allow what the situation in Hopf bifurcation to occur of a complex conjugate pair crossing the imaginary axis, well, as this pair approaches, its negatives will also approach from the other side, and they will collide and be double on the imaginary axis. So it's impossible in a Hamiltonian system to have, find the right, yeah, here it is, impossible to have Hopf bifurcation. The classical Hopf bifurcation is impossible in Hamiltonian systems because you can never get simple eigenvalues crossing. There is a sort of simplest thing that can happen, though, if you think about it from this rule. If you have purely imaginary eigenvalues, by the same argument, they're trapped on the imaginary axis if they're simple because they don't have a twin to go the other way. But if you have two pairs like this on the imaginary axis that come together and coalesce, now they could separate and go off into a quartet. Pardon me? Depending on the index, right. But this is the case that I'm interested in here. Yeah. So as mu goes through zero, I mean, they can just pass through each other, of course, but as mu goes through zero for the case that I'm interested in, they coalesce and split off in the other direction, the non-semi-simple case. So let me continue. This is what we're interested in the linearization, but really we're interested in the full nonlinear Hamiltonian system, and there are a couple of important theorems for that tell us what happens typically near an equilibrium point of a Hamiltonian system when you know about its eigenvalues. So let's suppose we have a Hamiltonian system with an equilibrium point that I'll call Q0, P0, and the Hamiltonian is smooth and satisfies some non-degeneracy conditions, which are not restrictive. If I linearize at that equilibrium point and calculate the eigenvalues, if I find a pure imaginary pair like this, and the other M satisfy this condition that the ratio to the pair I'm interested in is not an integer. So I can have other purely imaginary eigenvalues, that's okay, but they're not integer multiples of the pair that I'm looking at. Then there's a one-parameter family of periodic orbits, a center, a nonlinear center existing around that equilibrium point. So this would apply, of course, to go back to this case, then if this is my linearization with two simple pairs, and they're close together, so they're clearly not, one's not an integer multiple of the other, so the Lyapunov center theorem says that I can expect a family of periodic orbits or center around the equilibrium in each of those eigenspaces, corresponding to each of the eigenspaces of simple eigenvalues. The other generic case is covered by the stable manifold theorem. Suppose the linearization at the equilibrium point has eigenvalues for which none have zero real part. Okay, this is the hyperbolic case. No eigenvalues in the imaginary axis. They are all positive or negative real part. Let's say D with negative and M minus D have positive real part. In that case, there is a neighborhood of the equilibrium point in which there exist smooth manifolds, the so-called stable and unstable manifolds, whose dimensions are D and M minus D, respectively, dimensions of the stable and unstable subspaces corresponding to the eigenvalues up here, usually written ES and EU. They're the same dimensions. They're also tangent to these stable and unstable subspaces, and they have the same growth properties that in the stable manifold, all solutions tend to the equilibrium point as T goes to plus infinity. In the unstable manifold, they all leave, or if you prefer, they approach the equilibrium as T goes to minus infinity. You get exponential bounds. You have an exponential dichotomy, as it's called, on these growth rates. So that would apply to our other hyperbolic picture here. Here is a pair of eigenvalues with negative real part, positive real part, nothing on the imaginary axis. Is a hyperbolic problem, so I would have, in this case, two-dimensional stable and unstable manifolds preserved in the nonlinear system. So I can restate my original question that I started with the problem, a small sub-question of the original problem, is how do we reconcile these two extremely different pictures? Here you have these two centers. Here you have stable and unstable hyperbolic manifolds. Each of those theorems, the Lyapunov center theorem, the stable manifold theorem, is true arbitrarily close to where they meet here. As long as they're not touching, they could be this way or that way. It seems highly discontinuous. How does it all fit together? Well, that question was answered first, I think, to my knowledge, by Meyer and Schmidt, Ken Mayer, in 1971. In what is now called the Hamiltonian-Hopf bifurcation theorem. They didn't call it that, but they didn't really give it a name. But it's not called the Mayer-Schmidt theorem, it's called Hamiltonian-Hopf theorem. And so their assumptions are you have a Hamiltonian system, double imaginary eigenvalues, non-degeneracy conditions, which include non-semi-simplicity and the eigenvalue behavior that I had before, and certain nonlinear terms don't vanish that normally wouldn't. And they are able to show then that in a neighborhood of the equilibrium point, there are two families of periodic solutions, two centers, if you like. And I'll just state the theorem in these pictures rather than in words. There are two cases depending on a nonlinear term, which of course doesn't exist in the linear case. The sign of a nonlinear term, which I've called C0 up here, something like the cubic coefficient in the Hopf theorem that tells you whether it's super or subcritical, only it's much richer here. If you look along just the bottom of these pictures, you see branches of periodic solutions coming off of 0. The vertical axis R is just amplitude of the periodic solution, so R equals 0 is the equilibrium. The x-axis here is the delta omega is the spacing between the imaginary eigenvalues, the separation, the detuning, if you like, how far apart they are on the imaginary axis. So as I vary mu, let's start with mu less than mu naught corresponds to mu negative in this picture over here. So let me maybe put this here and this here. Get them both at once. Okay, so here I'm assuming when mu is less than mu naught, I have two pairs of purely imaginary eigenvalues that are non-resonant. So the Lyapunov center theorem says there should be two families of periodic solutions, And, well, here they are. One family on this side, one family on this side for a given curve is a given fixed value of mu and a given fixed two pairs. Nonlinear terms, in the case where this nonlinear coefficient is positive, cause those two families to join. So you have this sort of elliptic picture, but this is not elliptic in the phase space sense, it's ellipsis in the bifurcation diagram of amplitude versus detuning, which of course is related to directly to the parameter mu. The other case, the other sign of the nonlinear coefficient. Pardon me? Yes, it's the same family. Yes. You have a bifurcation here, and so it gets twisted around. It's in a four-dimensional space, and it's locally, so the local theorem, the Lyapunov center theorem already gives you that there is a center corresponding to each of those imaginary eigenvalues in its own eigenspace. The Meyer-Schmidt theorem says that, in a sense, there's, for a given value of mu, it's really only one family that joins these two centers. Yes? No, this is only for the case where they do this dance, right, with a negative 1 in the normal form, non-semi-simple negative. This is the same linearization in that way, but with a different sign to the nonlinear coefficient, which has nothing to do with the index of the linearization. Again, the Lyapunov center theorem says there will be centers as long as there are imaginary eigenvalues, which by our convention means mu is negative. But now as mu goes to zero, and the delta omega, the detuning goes to zero, they coalesce. But there are still two families, which then break off and lift away. And so now for mu positive, that is over here on the hyperbolic side, you have, sure enough, a hyperbolic equilibrium point down here, but there are still periodic solutions nearby that have lifted off. So quite different behavior in the two cases. And so here's Ken Meyer, many of you probably know, a recent picture. The key tool, there are several, quite a few proofs actually of this theorem around now, but most of them rely on using the Hamiltonian normal form. Obviously, you're not going to get the big picture if you just apply the Lyapunov center theorem at each center. You just get the two little pieces. You have to look at the full four-dimensional system and see how the two eigenmodes, if you like, interact and how they're coupled. And they're coupled. The important coupling is this term here that makes it non-semi-simple in the linear part. Hamiltonian normal form has two real functions, real valued p and q, even though I'm using complex coordinates here, and they have very special properties which allow you to get estimates on these branches of periodic solutions, which I promise I'm not going to go into any calculations. So that's it. All right, as I said at the beginning, a little breather here, the world has lots of resonances, but not everything is Hamiltonian. You can expect, periodic motion and coupling of systems, and frequencies could be equal, which is what those double eigenvalues mean, but not always Hamiltonian. It might be near Hamiltonian. So it needs to look at the situation of double imaginary eigenvalues without the Hamiltonian assumption. And I will use near Hamiltonian and weakly dissipative as the same thing. I'll say anything that's not Hamiltonian has dissipation. And it's really sort of two kinds of dissipation, but I won't just worry about that. So if there's dissipation, you lose the Hamiltonian structure. And now the question is, what happens when there's dissipation a little bit added to the Hamiltonian Hopf that is quite well understood now? Well, if you just look at the linear part, the eigenvalues, so supposing you had double pure imaginary eigenvalues at these two dots, now they're free to move any way they want. They don't have to do the Hamiltonian dance. They can move off in different directions. Of course, they must remain complex conjugate pairs. There's still that restriction, but they can go, the real parts can change independently. They don't have to remain mirror images, and the imaginary part can move away from each other. It's really just the ratio of the two imaginary parts we're interested in, whether they're one-to-one or bigger or less than one. So there are, in a sense, three dimensions of freedom here, three free parameters to play with, or codimension is three, which can be defined, of course, in a technical sense that I won't go into here. So to study general Hopf bifurcation at one-to-one resonance, you will have much, much richer behavior. So I studied this problem some time ago. My first study of this problem was with G is Stefan van Gils, K is Martin Krupa, and L, of course, is me some time ago, and I can give you that paper if you're interested in it. Here we were not thinking Hamiltonian at all, just, you know, what happens if two Hopf bifurcations happen to coincide, just be resonant. And so it's convenient, again, to complexify, as one does also in the Hamiltonian case. So you have two complex equations and bring it to a normal form, the simple form of the matrix we're interested in. The non-semi-simple case is like this. And there is a nice paper of Arnold on universal unfoldings of matrices, in which he says that all matrices close to this one after a similarity transformation can be made to look like that, and you only need three parameters to describe all such nearby matrices up to similarity transformation. And so we take his choice of unfolding, which means a real alpha here. So this is obviously just the real part crossing when you put that in. And mu down here is complex, and it provides the other 2 degrees of freedom. And it's easy to verify that then with alpha and mu 1 and mu 2, you can move these, split the double imaginary eigenvalues any way they want to go. They're free to move in all directions. So in that sense, the degeneracy is unfolded. The normal form in the dissipative case, it looks much like the Hamiltonian, but it's more general. These functions, which I've written as phi 1 and phi 2, are now complex. So each represents two real functions. The invariant polynomials turn out to be exactly the same, these two invariants here. And the unfolding parameters are here. It's true in both Hamiltonian dissipative cases that if you set in the normal form, the truncated normal form, of course there are higher order terms that do not have this form, but in the truncated normal form, if I set Z1 equal to 0 here, that forces Z2 equals 0, and it was suggested actually by Martin Krupa that maybe that suggests that writing Z1 as a factor of Z2, making this singular change of coordinates, and now working with Z1 and W as your independent variables. The second observation is there's symmetry here, in particular an S1 rotational symmetry in the normal form, so you should be able to factor that out and reduce the dimension by one. And so incorporating those ideas, so here are the new coordinates. Using R and theta to take advantage of the rotational symmetry and the factor of W here. Plugging that in, you get the normal form looks like this. A three-dimensional real system. Now we're no longer complex. The phase equation has factored out here, decoupled from the other two. So now if I find a steady state, a non-zero equilibrium of this three-dimensional real system, going back to the original coordinates and solving the theta equation, this would be a periodic orbit of the original four-dimensional system. So equilibrium points of this system are periodic orbits of what we started with. A periodic orbit of this three-dimensional system, which is quite conceivable could happen in a three-dimensional system, would be Modulo some technical work that has to be done would give you an invariant torus in the original four-dimensional system. So there's potential for lots of interesting behavior there. Remember, we had three parameters, which are here labeled as alpha, mu1, and mu2. Mu up this way, mu that way, and alpha down this way. If you first look for, as I said in the normal Krupa normal form, an equilibrium point of this system would be a periodic solution. The Hopf bifurcation in the original system then corresponds to a pitchfork bifurcation in the amplitude equation. So we look for a pitchfork bifurcation of the amplitude equation and do the algebra, and you find out there is always pitchfork bifurcation, and it occurs on this surface, relating the three parameters in this very simple way. Right? There are no complicated coefficients here, just the three unfolding parameters. And if you plot this surface in the three-dimensional parameter space, you get this weird shape here, which we did in that paper that I referenced with Stefan and Martin. And the significance of this surface is as your parameters cross this surface at any point, if you cross transversely, then you can expect a classical Hopf bifurcation in the original problem. So there'll be one more periodic orbit on one side than the other, the birth or death of a limit cycle as you cross that surface. So underneath or inside, you can show, looking at the nonlinear terms, there's always one solution. On the outside, it's either 0 or 2, depending on where you cross. And there is another surface. Yes, I have it. You can go further, and there is a... So this, I should turn it this way. So this is a vertical slice through the umbrella. You saw the other way, close to the handle, perhaps, where it's thin. And there is a line, which you see more clearly here, coming off the umbrella, which separates, as I said, on the outside, there's either zero or two solutions. There's a line that separates those two cases. This is a line of saddle nodes of periodic orbits. Similarly here, there's another region. As I said, it's conceivable there could be a Hopf bifurcation in the amplitude equations. Well, in fact, we find that. The shaded region is where the amplitudes oscillate with another frequency, so that can be expected to be quasi-periodic tori, invariant tori in the original problem. Well, I have to admit that I had no idea that was a Whitney umbrella when we found it. It wasn't until John Guggenheimer saw this work, and he said, oh, that's a Whitney umbrella. And then 2 seconds later, he said, of course, what else would you expect? And I thought, wow, I got to learn about Whitney umbrellas. So here's some nice pictures from Maple. This doesn't help you understand it any better, but you can see it better, perhaps, than my other picture. So you see that this is the Whitney umbrella for our system. And do I have time for a little demo? I found it fascinating. I hope you will enjoy too. Why did we rediscover or crash into this Whitney umbrella, which has been around for years, but I knew nothing about. But people in singularity theory, of course, know very well this Whitney umbrella is something important, and I just had no idea. I'd never studied it. Well, Whitney was studying, as you see here. Here's Whitney as a young man. And here's the paper where the Whitney umbrella first appeared, Duke Math Journal. Singularity set of 2n-1 smooth functions of n variables. Take n equal to 2. Okay, so then 2n-1 is 3. So a function of 2 variables to 3 functions of 2 variables. So you can think of it as a mapping from R2 into R3, basically, is what he has. And he lived in Switzerland in his later years. I don't know if he was climbing at that age, at that time. I don't know how he died, but he was. He wasn't visiting. He moved. His home was Switzerland. That much I know. So this, of course, is the surface of which maps the a plane to R3, right? And he was looking at what typically happens if you map, take a plane. So here's a plane, right? Map it into R3. If you don't cut it, ignore the little cuts there for the moment, or tear it or anything. It's rather trivial, but he's looking at singular mappings that can self-intersect. So the first non-trivial, from a topologist point of view, mapping from R2 to R3 would be a surface, would create a surface that intersects itself sort of like this. Okay, so there is a self-intersecting map from 2 to 3 dimensions. And if you think about it, it's going to, so generically it'll intersect transversely, as I'm trying to show there, and it'll intersect along a line, which doesn't have to be a straight line, but imagine it's sort of straight. Then you're going to have a loop, as you see here, on one side of the line and two wings on the other side. Well, if this is non-degenerate, then that loop will not be a perfect cylinder extending forever. It's going to taper one way or the other. It'll have to taper down, as you can see here, till it disappears. Right? Generically, if you have a self-intersecting circle with a transverse intersection and it's, you know, not parallel cylinder, it's going to taper down and this loop will disappear one direction or the other. The point where it disappears, that's special. That's right there. That's where the Whitney umbrella appears. So it is a generic important thing. Probably all of you knew this and I didn't, but this is how the Whitney umbrella arises, no, not in this very natural context. When you map a plane to 3-space and let it self-intersect, you expect to have a Whitney umbrella, and so we did. And so this wasn't such a weird surface after all. It's really generic. Pardon me? Well, the joke is that, you know, Whitney had two friends, and he was very kind-hearted because he held the umbrella, and his friends did try. It's sometimes drawn the other way up, but I like it this way. All right, so back to the problem. And maybe I'm not going to finish so early after all, but I'm nearly done. There's this line of singularities where the Whitney umbrella self-intersects, as I just showed you with a paper model. This, of course, has been normalized to make, you know, lots of symmetry and everything. It doesn't have to be like that, but in the simplest topological normal form, the Whitney umbrella gives you a shape like this. This line of self-intersections where it crosses transversely up to the singularity, I'll call that the handle of the umbrella. When you draw it this way, that's right. That's where the handle would be. Guess where the Hamiltonian case lies? The Hamiltonian normal form is this. It's not just coincidence that I use the same mu here as we did as in the Hamiltonian Hopf theorem, where there's only one parameter. That mu is this mu, and the Hamiltonian case is the handle of this Whitney umbrella. So that's the first insight. So near Hamiltonian, obviously, means you take a little cylinder around the handle, and you look very carefully at what happens when you blow up the handle of the Whitney umbrella. So that's what we've done. And this is partially worked with Gerard Yost, as I mentioned. So here's a sketch. So if I slice just off the handle, just, you know, in front or behind that umbrella, I will get this parabolic shape like this. And there are two cases depending on nonlinear coefficients in the normal form. Either you have, remember, when you cross the umbrella, you get a Hopf bifurcation, which creates a periodic orbit. It can go to the outside or the inside. For one choice of signs, it goes to the inside, and these green lines are the periodic orbits, the limit cycles joining two Hopf bifurcations, one on each side. There's that line of saddle nodes that I mentioned, but weak dissipation means B is very small, which means that line of saddle nodes sort of goes way down out of the picture. It's non-local. Okay? So as far as Hamiltonian Hopf, or near Hamiltonian Hopf, you have this simple picture here with loops of periodic orbits joining two Hopf bifurcations. For the other sign, the local Hopf bifurcation goes outward, and it persists above the handle, is for mu positive, above the umbrella. If you go up into space where the handle would be, there are still periodic orbits out there, and there are on both sides. Again, there's this line of saddle nodes, which is important if B is not small, but for B small, it slides down the umbrella and is non-local. So we get kind of like in the classical Hopf theorem, where you can consider the center as a degenerate collapsed version of between the two super and subcritical Hopf bifurcations. We get an analogous situation here. This summarizes our results so far. First, a linearization. Hamiltonian Hopf bifurcation corresponds to the handle of the Whitney umbrella, just that one-dimensional path through it, but the most singular path through the umbrella, the most interesting part. And the limit as dissipation goes to zero, we can match up, we can connect up our picture for the dissipative case and the classical Hamiltonian Hopf case. So, conclusions, I guess I've already stated. Lots of other questions, which I won't go into. So I'm finished, and I thank you for your attention.